Welcome to the very first installment of Native Traveler. I'm your host, Liz Beatty, on Canada Talk Sirius XM Channel 167. We have got a brilliant show ahead. First, writer, blogger, and British expat in Mexico, Susanna Rigg, takes us deep into the remote jungle of southern Mexico, where we meet the isolated and mysterious community of Lacandon Maya. Next, we'll learn about the ultimate foodie pilgrimage with Chef Mario Jimenez of the famed Yucatan Los Dos Cooking School. But first, here's my story of how a recent trip to the Yucatan broke through some common stereotypes about Mexico. I call this very first Native Traveler feature the Full Maya. So the truth is, it was never a conscious thing not to go to Mexico. But now I admit, there might have been the odd stereotype in the way. I likely envisioned just all-inclusives. I no doubt pictured bachelorette soirees where most of the group missed the bus to Chichen Itza and spent days over-communicating between tequila shots. Of course, there would be stunning beaches, but I'm not so much a sun and sand girl, and I don't think I'm a group travel girl, and definitely, I'm not really a resort girl. I mean, I'm an exploring kind of traveler. Who needs all that pampering? So, of course, when a friend invited me on a girl's luxury, spiritual, bonding getaway to Mexico's Riviera Maya, well, I just had to say yes. I mean, what is travel if not an opportunity to challenge our hardened beliefs, to invite personal transformation? So, with such higher purpose in mind, yo fui, which is to say in local parlance, I went. The margarita slipped in my hand as I exit the limo at the Belmont Maroma Resort and Spa is a nice touch for this weary traveler, so is being whisked off to a torch-lit feast barefoot on the beach. My 12 fellow travelers are already mid-fed. Bright moonlight sparkles off the pounding surf. The breeze is warm, the stylish women and one brave man, all between 30 and 60-something, are easy company from sip one of some local vintage. I raise a glass to our hosts, travel mavens Deb and Allison, at the Divine Destination Collection. Okay, this beach thing is kind of nice. And the next morning, I awake to this. A tiny iridescent yellow bird chirps inches from my window. Then two bright red ones land on the branch behind him. A huge raven-like guy with teal wings swoops in. I'm feeling a bit like 1937 animated Snow White in the forest scene. I mean, these mangroves of the Yucatan that seem to be swallowing my villa whole as I speak, teem with light, buzzing, chirping, humming. The nearby surf keeps a slow, steady rhythm to it all. Hey, there's an iguana, seriously, just sauntering by. Okay, this Maya version of paradise so far is a little impressive, but what's the real twist this weekend?
Hola, buenas tardes, caballeros. ¿Cómo están?
That's our local insider, Allison, who looks more like a native of Dingle, Ireland. Vibrant red curls and creamy white skin. After living and working here in years past, Allison can pull off the upward chin tilt and downward stare of a fierce Latina. I like her instantly, along with her more laid-back business partner, Deb. These two Uber trip planners are pivoting creatively after decades working the demanding luxe world of meeting and incentives travel. Here's Deb.
Al and I are both seekers. We both believe in a higher being. You know, we're into professional and personal development, and we've always been interested in introspection and all things sacred and mystical around the world. Mm-hmm. But not religious.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah. So our conversations just in casual social get-togethers always turn to spirituality and
deeper fodder.
Yeah. Going inside ourselves and being more. We both really try to live our lives in alignment with our souls. not sure we're there yet, but we're drawing.
We started to just explore this idea. What if we could combine luxury and unique travel experiences with spirituality? And we were both like...
Because they've always been mutually exclusive, right?
Yeah.
Like, you had your luxury, and it's very sort of elitist and no sort of soul to it. Or if you wanted to dive deeper, you'd go to an ashram, sleep on a mat, and have bad food for a month. And we thought, why can't we combine the two?
Yeah.
Okay. I dig the notion of spiritual luxury. I am all over paradox. But then both women talk about this phenomenon among their groups of travelers, this inevitability.
More than I can possibly explain to you. It was, it was like this camaraderie, and everybody opened up. Everybody's singing, everybody's dancing. Even if it was chilly, or if it was dappling with rain, it was everybody just... I don't know, it took everybody to a different level of bonding.
And here's where I start to get squirmy. Not about this concept of bonding, but about me in this concept. We'll see. It's our first morning. Maya healing apprentices Patty and Daniela conduct a smudging ceremony with smoldering lemongrass and rosemary. Then we meet our shaman Paco. He's older, short, stout, with a broad, disarming grin. Outside our meditation room, he tells me to smile, then repeats this, eventually making me understand that I need to unfurl my almost permanently knitted brow. The Botox needed here would surely exceed safe dosages. He's right. I do carry the weight of my world there. Next to him, beautiful Patty speaks volumes with her warm gaze, but not a word of English. Young Daniela, in a feathered headdress, body paint, and bright orange robes, keeps the slow beat with her shamanic ankle rattles. One by one, we settle on our yoga mats.
In Latin America,
we have to learn these words. She's thanking, giving you thank you. We have all of us for you to be here, and we have something to share with you. In Lakech, I am you. A Lakech, you are me.
Yes.
I repeat.
In Lakech.
In Lakech.
A Lakech.
A Lakech.
Desde el corazón.
In Lakesh, Alagesh is the living code of the heart. It's a greeting, but also a guiding principle to Maya spirituality. Basically, it means we're all the same. We are all one. Words to live by in these wonky times. And it's also a call to action, meaning give good energy, and good energy will be returned to you. Paco is living proof of this through the week. In Playa del Carmen, at a restaurant set within an actual sinkhole known as a cenote, Paco shares how the Maya believe the rain god Shaq resided in such caves, and how local farmers here, in some measure, still do today. At breakfast, he describes the meteor strike of the Yucatan 66 million years ago that scientists now acknowledge likely extinguished most life on Earth, including the dinosaurs. Smaller pieces of the meteor punched holes through the Yucatan's limestone cap to form the region's many cenotes. No wonder the Maya revere these mystical waterholes and the stars above them. Here, and at every other meeting, we begin and end with In Lakesh, A Lakesh, and each time it rings truer. Later, a guided swim deep into a cenote cave exhilarates, but exhausts us. Afterward, Paco rides shotgun next to the driver back to our hotel. He starts delving deeper into archaeological insights of this sacred landscape, until Allison whispers from behind that the entire van is asleep. He chuckles, goes silent. For sure, over the week, Paco, Patty, and Daniela become more like friends, sharing their love of their home, their roots. It's a frame on everything that prepares us all for one particularly special evening. Our drive inland extends over an hour, Truth is, I've come to enjoy these group rides. They create space for conversation. I've explored with Susan the uncivil bits of political correctness that maybe helped create Trumplandia. Deb and I unpacked staying connected to our grown sons. On this trip, Nancy and Terry share more about their worldwide spiritual pilgrimages. Finally, the van slows and a young man opens a nondescript gate. Here we turn onto a dirt track. The jungle scratches at both sides of our van.
Do you see this tree? This one here?
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to see the guts or the X? It looks like an X.
This big tree here,
can you see like the X?
If the window could open, we could touch these big X's hacked into tree trunks 60 years ago by local workers. They were harvesting chicle gum for the Wrigley Gum Company. Yes, for chiclets. So all we've been told is to bring a bathing suit, a cover-up, and bug spray far from our pampering digs at the coast. And just when the track ahead seems it can't get any narrower, we arrive. On the far side of an arch made of chicle branches, a throng of young children of Mayan descent greet us. They wear white outfits with colorful embroidery. Without prompting, they embrace us, kiss our cheeks, and scurry off to play. This is their community ceremonial ground, off the grid in every sense. As a warrior protector in full ceremonial garb and body paint stands guard, we surround a stoked fire warming large lava rocks. Our female shaman begins.
Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. Gualitenalti. Bienvenidos a esta ceremonia de Temazcal.
Welcome to this Temazcal ceremony.
Este Temazcal es el regreso al útero materno.
This Temazcal is a return to mother's womb.
Está representado en forma.
That is represented by this form.
Así que deben de estar tranquilas, no pasa nada.
You should all take it easy, be at ease, nothing will happen.
La idea es que ustedes experimenten la paz que sentían cuando estaban en el vientre de su madre.
The idea is that we all experience the peace that we had when we were in our mother's womb. Mm.
Y aprovechando ese estado, vamos a hacer que nuestro cuerpo se purifique y se reestructure.
And in that mother's womb, we will take advantage of the fact that we will purify and restructure our body and DNA.
Para que cuando salgan sea como un nuevo renacimiento.
So that when we come out, we are reborn. Okay.
Dejen que fluyan sus emociones, relájense, sean como niños, porque ahora se van a convertir en eso.
Let your emotions flow, go back to when you were a child, and be a child.
Mm. Soon, one by one, we enter the Temazcal, a low igloo-shaped structure. The narrow entryway denotes birth and death, good, evil, and other elemental opposites. We find our places on the curved bench inside, piling in left to right as the planets move. The rocks from the fire, called Grandmother Knowledge, are placed in the center. We rub cleansing sprigs of basil on our bodies. Finally, the hole at the top is covered and the door closes. It's smoky, but that passes. There's total darkness now, except for the glow of the stones. Perspiration flows as our shaman helps us purify physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. Surrender kind of feels involuntary. Still, there's no over-emoting when we all emerge, just an otherworldly swim in a nearby cenote under the stars. It's quite a thing to sweat almost naked with near strangers for an hour, facing into the messy stuff of our humanity, an elder sidling up to her mortality, a wife with an ill husband, a sister with broken sibling relationships, a single mom healing from divorce, and on. Still, the true telltale of this connection, for me, comes later. Festivities the next evening could not be more contrasting. Amid the long shadows of a cloudless twilight, our chic Venetian-style boat, stocked with select vintages and scrumptious nibbles, cruises the mangroves. After 2.5 Chardonnays, I hold forth with a confession of sorts. It begins something like this. When I was 14, I used to wrap my thighs in saran wrap at night, figuring I could sweat them down to look like those of Farrah Fawcett. I mean, I already had good hair. The group looks on puzzled, wondering where this is going. I continue. Today, in that searing midday heat at Tulum, hiking around those ruins, I stop for a sip. My jeans felt a lot like that saran wrap. The cackles burst forth. What do you not understand about the instructions? Wear loose, light clothing, says Shiona. We thought you were nuts, says Elaine. Recycle, recycle, adds Allison about the lure of unworn but impractical items in our suitcases. And the playful pile-on continues. The thing is, finding a way into deep, meaningful conversations has always been kind of easy for me. But being surrounded by those who will joyfully mock me, now that's the sign of true intimates. Later, we step out of the busy resort bar into the still night. Two musicians begin playing dueling guitars as if on cue. Our one-man Terry and his partner Nancy have opted for an evening alone. Deb and Donna create a pop-up dance floor on this sweeping patio under the Yucatan stars. Not normally a group dance gal, and less so in my middle years. But this night, I'm just letting it go with my girls. I guess it is as Deb promised. At one with this lush, resonant place, we have indeed entered a whole new level of bonding. Go figure. Learn more at DivineDestinationCollection.com or for flights, Aeromexico.com. Up next, a true Mexico insider. I'm Liz Beattie. This is Native Traveler on Sirius XM, Canada Talks, Channel 167.
Soy un hombre muy honrado que me gusta lo mejor.
Welcome back to Native Traveler on Sirius XM Canada Talks 167. I'm your host, Liz Beattie. Now, when you think of food experiences in Mexico, it's hard not to think of the Los Dos Cooking School in Mérida, Yucatan. Los Dos was founded by the revered late chef David Sterling, who passed away just last November. Celebrities, critics, food writers from Martha Stewart to the New York Times, National Geographic, they tout Los Dos as one of the great foodie pilgrimages of the world. We're thrilled to have with us today on the line Los Dos director, chef Mario Jimenez, to talk about the legacy of Chef David and what's next for the school. Welcome, Mario.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Great to have you here. You know, in the foreword of David's extraordinary cookbook, Yucatan, he describes you as an amazing assistant, sous chef, researcher, photographer, trip planner. He describes you as possessing suave liaison skills and sometimes secretive local cooks and vendors. What was it like working so closely with David? I guess it's about 13 years and helping him develop the school and that wonderful cookbook.
Well, actually, he said that because he was too nice. But yeah, I have been working with him since the last 14 years when he was developing the idea of what to do when he just moved to Mexico. At that time, he was thinking about the idea of teaching French cuisine and French techniques to the actual people that live here in Mérida. Mm-hmm. But then he figured it out and he realized that the rich people here doesn't like to cook. So that was like an idea that it didn't work for us at the beginning. And then we start to think about what we can do here in the area. And I just say to David, well, why don't we focus in the Yucatecan cuisine and we offer that that opportunity and experience to foreigner clients. And since then, we started with the idea. And with the pass of the time, with the pass of the years, many people arrive here, enjoy the classes, enjoy David's knowledge and the passion that he used to have for Yucatan and the cuisine and the food and also the people who live here. And since then, because we were so lucky and we put a lot of effort and hard work to the school, we hit success with the pass of the time. And we are really, really happy that that the job and the work and all that we like to do keeps going on.
Well, there's just so many travelers from virtually every corner of the globe that have come to visit you. Now, David came to Merida via Oklahoma and then 25 years in New York City, but you were born and bred in the area, and your passion for local cuisine, I understand, started early in life. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, exactly. I was born in Mexico City, and because my dad, my dad is from this area, so I have Mayan blood run through my veins. Mm. And when I was born in Mexico City, it was because of my dad's line of work. Then we moved here to base the family here, so the kids grew up in a safe and quiet place. And I have been living here in Yucatan since then. So that's why I have a really big and genuine love for the people and everything here. And as you can imagine, I really enjoy to eat and to cook the Mayan cuisine. Okay. So I have all my career was developed here. And when I met David, he told me how to start to experience the kitchen. He told me how to the French and basic techniques in order to have the backup of an unusual chef. And since then, I have been working with him for the last 13 years side by side in the kitchen, and as well as all the arrangements and the investigation, research, and development for the book. We were together step by step.
Now about the book, the book is just, it's almost inappropriate to describe it as just a cookbook, because he writes so beautifully about culture, climate, history, markets, cities, ecosystems, and more. It's almost as though, it's the vision of food is bigger than food. It's about sort of local culture. Tell us how your cooking school really sort of uses food as a way to give people a window to Yucatan culture.
Well, actually, if you have visited Mexico, it's a huge place talking about cuisines and types of food that we have here. Yucatan, it's a really special and particular place because it's completely different from other parts of Mexico. In Mexico, in central Mexico, in Mexico City, Guadalajara, Querétaro, all these places, they really like the sweet and greasy food because the weather they have there. But in Yucatan, we really like salty, spicy, and hot food. Makes it really particular and special is that we have condiments and seasonal blends that you cannot find anywhere else in Mexico.
Give us the 101 on some of your primary ingredients that really define the local fare.
For example, we have here what we call sour orange. Is that I think in the States you call it Seville orange. It's a variety of the orange in here, and we cook everything with it. It's our marinated juice that we use it for almost all of our really important and particular dishes. And that's one of the things that is very, very particular. And it's a small ingredient. It's a small change on just one ingredient, but the flavor completely changes. For example, I can give you a small example. You know what is a pico de gallo, the Mexican sauce that is everywhere, and it's really loved by everyone who tastes it. We have our own version of pico de gallo. The pico de gallo original is just chopped tomato, Roma tomato, chopped cilantro, chopped onion, adding lemon juice and chile serrano. That's the original version. In Yucatan, we have the same thing, but we changed two ingredients. Instead of using lime, we use sour orange juice, and instead of using chile serrano, we use our chile habanero, which, as you know, is one of the most particular things here in Yucatan. So those two ingredients, you may think that it doesn't change a lot of the flavor, but it does.
Oh, my gosh, you're going to have to stop. You're making me hungry. Now, this is This is Native Traveler. I'm your host Liz Beattie on Canada Talk SiriusXM 167, and we are talking with Chef Mario of the Losdorf Cooking School. You know what? I read as well in a book called The People's Food that David says finding the best food in the Yucatan requires looking beyond restaurants to front porches and rolling carts, butcher storefronts. And I understand you often lead these adventures for your students or guests, you know, cantina crawls or street eats and the like. Can you describe some of these experiences off the beaten track?
Yes, what happened is that when we were doing all the research and development for his book, you know, in Mérida we have a lot of restaurants, but we start to find some errors that they did in order to, you know, deliver the real Yucatecan recipe. What happened is that, as you know, the restaurants are a business. So they cook and they prepare the dishes in order to sell. So the actual real food, it's, as you said, it's in stalls, it's in markets, it's where the people really know how to do it, and they conserve or kept the way that they were teach to, in order to do these regional recipes. Like, for example, if you go to a market, you know for sure that the lady who is selling, for example, cochinita pibil sandwiches, she had a recipe from her grandmother or something like that. So the flavor is really different from where you get in the restaurants. Another mistake that the restaurants make, and this is just an example, for example, the cochinita pibil recipe in restaurants, if you go there, they serve you in a plate cochinita pibil, which is pork cooked underground, marinated in achiote, and they garnish with maybe white rice, a little bit of black dried beans, and what we call cebollas encurtidas, which is pickled onions. That's a mistake, because when you go to a local town, people, a real decent Yucatecan, knows that you never eat or serve cochinita pibil as that. Like
now,
that.
You have a new program, do you not, that really takes people into local kitchens. Can you describe that for us?
Of course, we have the what we call Cocina Económica. Cocina Económica means cheap kitchen. It's a whole concept and a huge concept here in Mexico, in the entire Mexico, but we are focused just in the Cocinas Económicas here in Yucatan. Cocina Económica is a business mostly run by an old lady, and it's homemade food prepared in their own kitchen and ready to be taken or eaten in there. So the experience that we offer as Cocina Económica here at Los Dos is that we took our clients to an actual Mayan house, and we are going to cook with an actual real Mayan lady, you know, talking about all the history of this recipe, the flavors that we were using, the condiment, the special seasonal blends that we use, and of course we spend some really important and great time with the family, knowing all the people who he's helping in the house, you know, explaining everything, where she got this recipe and all that. So it's a really nice experience for the ones who doesn't have the full time in order to take a taste of Yucatan with us, but that they actually want to live the real experience. So Cocina Económica, that's why it's very famous between our clients, and we are really happy to do that. And as you said, it's totally, totally correct. I take the clients personally in my car, and I took them with me to all these places, markets, the Mayan lady house, the kitchen. We even have a tasting of, I just explained to you, the difference between a cochinita pibil in a restaurant and a cochinita pibil in this lovely stall.
And Mario, how does all this relate to the slow food Yucatan movement that David was such a strong part of?
Well, as you know, David was the founder of the chapter here in Yucatan many years ago. And by that time, we just have 5 vendors. Now we have, I think, a list of 35 different vendors of, you can imagine, the variety of options and products that they have. And we try to promote the local production, the local grow of ingredients, and as you can imagine, the love that that these people has for how they grow their ingredients and the food. The food is very important for them. It's not just in, you know, nutritional way. It's that they put love and a lot of effort and a lot of tradition in their food. So the relation that we have between slow food and our cuisine is that we are trying to recover all these ingredients that have been losing through the generations. Right now, you know, the young people start to change their traditions, and that's why we are trying to recover all that by promoting the Yucatecan cuisine.
Now, another way that you see your program connects with culture are these special events. I noticed on your website the one program around the Day of the Dead or Guadalupe Day. And tell us about those.
Well, these programs we actually developed together, David and I, because we wanted to sell, you know, type of classes, packages with where we offer accommodation, and because we have, as you know, in Mexico, everything is a party. So we have a lot of dates that we include. For example, the Day of the Dead in Mexico, it's huge. It's very special. It's a date where the colors and the traditions and the feelings and the emotions are involved. So it's fantastic. Another thing that I can tell you about Mérida is that Day of the Dead, it's spread along all the country. But here in Yucatan, it's different. What they do is that they respect, or they try to recover again the traditions of the Mayan people in order of the Day of the Dead, and here in Mérida we have a huge event of that, and we have lovely, beautiful stalls with food and all these things, but related to the date.
Well, Mario, so, you're making me want to plan my next trip. I just came back, but I'm going to have to return. Listen.
In fact, I can tell you one more different that we have a special tamal here in Yucatan that we just prepare and eat on that specific date.
Wonderful.
That tamal is what we call PIP, P-I-V. And it's a huge rounded tamal, like a pizza size or pizza shape, but completely crispy and stuffed with chicken or other fabulous ingredients. And
well, that's well, you just tell me where to come, where to be, and I'll be there next on the next date. Listen, Mario,
yeah, you can schedule your program with us, and we will be happy to.
Wonderful.
Of course, come with that.
Well, Mario, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Liz Beattie for Native Traveler on SiriusXM Canada Talks 167. There's more ahead, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Native Traveler on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. We are here today with travel writer, award-winning blogger Susanna Rigg. Susanna specializes in all things Mexican for Forbes Travel Guide, the Matador Network, and others. Welcome, Susanna.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. I see you worked with my friends at Truffle Pig as well.
I did, yes. A while ago, yes, I did.
That's great. Susanna, you fell in love with the idea of Mexico, the lore of the Aztecs, when you were just a little girl in Great Britain. Tell us how the reality, once you traveled there, lived up to the image in a 10-year-old imagination.
I can explain it by the sensations that I had when I arrived into Mexico. I arrived into Guadalajara, which is in the north, and all I can say is that I just felt like I was home. And it's one of those kind of feelings that you can't entirely explain rationally. Mm-hmm. But I lived with a family, and they made me feel like I was part of their family. They called me their British daughter. And it kind of just went from there, really. And from that moment, I wanted to live in Mexico. And 5 years later, I returned to live, and I've been here for 6 years.
That's wonderful. Now, you live in south central Mexico since 2010?
Yeah, I live in Oaxaca, which is in, well, it's sort of south, central south, west on the Pacific coast.
Right. And how have your perceptions changed since you moved to that region?
It's interesting. It's more complex now. When I first arrived, I think I had rose-tinted glasses about Mexico. I'm still, as my sister told me recently, she said my love affair with Mexico is like a love affair with a person. Mm-hmm. It has its ups and downs. But it's really interesting because I see the outside perspective of Mexico as being this dangerous place, you know, drug-fueled dangerous place that the media likes to portray it as. And that's not my reality. My reality is one of walking to my local market, having long conversations with the market sellers. The other day, one of the market sellers was eating something that looked really tasty, and I told her that, and she sat me down and had me eat with her and chat with her for 5 minutes.
I love the way you put it on your blog, where you say Mexico is full of compassionate, expressive people, that Mexico's bursting with flavor and temptation for all the senses. The Mexico that gets into your soul and never leaves. So what are some more of those gems that we need to know about that are not getting the profile that they deserve?
I think it is really that the senses all the time here. You're kind of being assaulted your senses are being assaulted, whether it's by amazing smells, sounds, colors. The color is something that lots of people who come to Mexico mention. It is so colourful, and I think the light, something about the light here makes things look so magical. So I can walk around my city, you know, I've been here for 6 years, and I still get stopped in my tracks by the amazing sky, the colours, a house will be bright yellow next to a house that's bright pink next to a flowering plant that's purple, and things like that that just, I certainly didn't see... in England, I mean, I lived in London. It's quite a relatively grey city with the weather as well. So I think it's that. That's one of the things.
Well, you certainly evoked for me a sense of the region in your story for BBC Travel, which is how we first connected. It's a great piece about experiencing an isolated, more untouched pocket of Maya culture. Now, just let's walk us through it. Tell us how you came across the guide that would introduce you to this Lacandon Maya.
Well, I met him in a library in the highland town of San Cristobal de las Casas, which is in Chiapas. I was there doing some research about the Lacandon Maya, because I'm actually writing a novel inspired by the region. And he walked in, and he was from the village that I was writing about, so we got talking, and then he turned out to be a tour guide and said, you know, come down. And so I pretty much jumped on the next bus down to the jungle, and it's incredible. You get taken into the jungle. There's lots of different places you can explore within the jungle. I decided to go to a place called the Lost City of Lacanca. So we went trekking through the jungle 4 or 5 hours. And it's just incredible. I wouldn't call it an archaeological site. I would actually call it a Mayan ruin, in the sense that it has been left. The jungle has essentially taken back over the stones. But these are stones that would have been there maybe 500 AD, something like that. So,
tell us a little bit about what you learned about the Lacandon Maya in terms of having escaped into the jungle. It's such a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. So when the Spanish arrived in the conquest, there were two different groups of Maya who escaped into the jungle, and they now are all called Lacandon. Some live in the north, some live in the south, and actually it's believed that their descendancy is different. The southerners are descendant from Yucatan Maya. They basically didn't want to be converted, and so they just escaped into the jungle, and the Spanish really didn't have the means to or perhaps the desire to follow them in. So they just went deeper and deeper into the jungle. They lived in really small pockets of maybe like one or two families. So they were really hard to kind of for the Spanish to get to. And they stayed in the jungle. I mean, there's many Lacandon-Maya who still live within the jungle settlements. They only really started to have contact with the outside world around the turn of the 20th century, when archaeologists and anthropologists and then later missionaries and loggers went into the jungle. And their life really changed quite a lot from then.
This is Native Traveler. I'm your host, Liz Beattie, on Canada Talk, SiriusXM 167. I am talking to Susanna Riggs, an award-winning blogger who is taking us deep into the jungle. Susanna, just to carry on about your exploration into this remote city, what did you discover when you get there? I mean, how long did it take you to hike in?
We were hiking for about 2.5 to 3 hours before we came to the site, and it was hot, it was humid, and you know, for them it's easy. We're walking, and suddenly we would see things like ants, these biting ants, and they'd be like, ants, quick, and we'd have to stamp as we walked through. Obviously, it's jungle. There's all sorts of animals living within the jungle. About 2.5 to 3 hours in, we got to the site, and it really has been left. I think the Archaeological Association of Mexico had gone in the 90s, so they know it's there, but they've done very little kind of excavation or research.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's mixed. The problem is that the amount of money that is given to this kind of research in Mexico isn't that high. So what sometimes happens is that organizations from the US, from Canada, from Europe come in and they do the excavations, which is a mixed bag. It's good because there's incredible people doing it, but sometimes it means interpretations of the site come from a European perspective or a US perspective, which isn't always helpful. That's changing, and that was more kind of in earlier days of exploration, so that's certainly changing in recent years.
And tell us about the sort of the diminishing jungle or habitat or environment of the people who live there. How are they dealing with that, and is that something that is progressing?
Yeah, it's progressing extremely fast. Since the 1980s, I think it's something like 70% of the jungle has diminished. It's a really, really big problem. Certainly Danielle, who I spent time with, he's been working in environmental programs trying to kind of use Lacandon knowledge of the jungle to give ways that perhaps the jungle doesn't need to be diminished. The jungle has been removed in order to create cattle farms generally, and logging, need the use of the wood. But the problem with the cattle farms is that then the land becomes used up, and then they can't use it any longer, so they move to the next piece of land and have to remove more trees. The Lacandon used to use a different system for their planting and growing called a milpa system, which meant that the land is always renewed. So Daniel's trying to talk to people about these systems, about how they might be able to move forward. But certainly a lot of the Lacandon have also been quite removed from their traditional ways of doing things, having to make money through tourism and those kind of things. So it's a difficult situation. But I know that Mexico is starting to take it relatively seriously, which is, really important because, the jungle is disappearing extremely quickly down there.
Now, 2017 is the year of sustainability and travel. So how is tourism helping the Lacandon maintain or sustain their culture and their way of life?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. For example, Daniel wears a white tunic, and he was telling me that actually a few years ago he didn't wear the tunic. And I asked him why, and he said actually because his dad passed away and asked him to carry on the tradition. But I have my suspicions as well. I asked him, I said, is it also good for tourism? And he said, yeah. So I think there's some level at which tourism is playing a role in kind of this sustaining of the tradition. And also for the Lacandon to, for example, Daniel learned a lot about the jungle and about the plants. He has an innate knowledge, but he also spent time learning more because he knew that that was good for tourism. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag in the sense that they're sustaining their lifestyle through tourism, and the tourists want to see traditional Mayan, Lacandon Maya life, you know. So I'm not quite sure of where I stand on it. I'm a bit on the fence as to whether it's a good or a bad thing. But certainly I know that for Daniel, his life depends on tourists coming to the jungle.
If people, our listeners, are interested in really seeking out this wonderful remote adventure, how would they go about doing that?
There's various different tour guides now within the Lacandon jungle. Daniel's, his is called Aventuras, which is like adventures, and Chankin, which is his last name, but it's also a first name within the Lacandon. Or you can just type in Lacandon jungle visits and you might find something. Most of it is in Spanish still because the, you know, they haven't really translated many of their pages into English as yet. It's still a really off the beaten track place to go, and not many tourists who go to Chiapas go. So I feel like it's a really good time to explore this area, actually. So that's probably the best way.
Well, thank you so much, Susanna, for this insight. Learn more about Insider Mexico at Susanna's award-winning blog, MexicoRetold.com. I'm Liz Beattie. This is Native Traveler on Canada Talk, Sirius XM 167. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Native Traveler. I'm your host, Liz Beattie. This is Canada Talk, Sirius XM 167. You know, Mexico is probably a great place to start for Native Traveler, probably because I think I had so many stereotypes before I went. And, you know, any place we go, we have a lot of expectations. And one of the things I think we hope to do with Native Traveler is to dig a little deeper, go beyond the bucket list, the trends and whatnot, and really give you a deeper cultural frame. I think, in my experience, those are the things you want to know before you travel, because they really impact everything you see once you step off that plane. Has anybody else experienced that?
I'm a big fan of urban travel and big cities. I love big cities and big city travel and big bustling cities. But I have noticed that I've been to Amsterdam a few times. That's a city that has lots of stereotypes and mystique and mythos about it. And small parts of it are true, but a lot of it isn't. And the farther you go from the center in Amsterdam, the farther out you go, either walking or biking or taking a tram, the more you see the real city and the more you see how really layered it is there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it's sort of Native Travel is really all about how people live. I mean, for me, you know, wanderlust is kind of a paradox. I call myself a traveling homebody, which I know sounds kind of weird. But the thing is that I love my home so much, and I love to find out what other people love about their homes. You know, it's their rhythms, it's their rituals, it's where they go to have coffee, to shop, to celebrate. And when I know those things, even when I go to see touristy things or non-touristy things, it really, it's like putting a chrome filter on what you're seeing.
Yeah, I'm finding now with Airbnb travel, when I stay in Airbnbs, there's often more personalized touch and notes left from the hosts, either through email exchange beforehand, or sometimes the hosts will prepare their own little booklet saying, in my neighborhood, coffee is here, restaurant is here, this kind of ethnic cuisine is here. And it's a little more personal than going to a big chain hotel on the big main street in a main city where the front all has pamphlets for the haunted house and the double-decker bus tour and so on and so forth. I've done those too. And sometimes those have led to learning more from locals. I have gone on the guided double-decker bus tour, and occasionally from the driver or the guide asked another question, where can I find better this? Where can I find better that? But yeah, sometimes the chain hotels just are what they are. They're chain hotels with pamphlets in the front.
Well, you know, sometimes the iconic sites are the things that they're almost like obligations. But I always say, you know, there's really nothing like brewing your morning coffee and sipping it on your patio in your own underwear in some foreign city. You know, I mean, to really feel like you live like a local. I also think that, you know, often the most memorable things, the things that you tell again and again at cocktail parties, are usually unplanned and free.
And stumbling upon things, turning a corner, seeing something. And, yeah, living small parts of living like a local, like you said, brewing your own coffee, forcing yourself to go to a local grocery store or a corner shop or a corner store rather than going to a restaurant every day and having a whatever the tourist breakfast is or the local breakfast. It forces you to just immerse yourself just that much more little by little.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can plan away. And, I mean, that's part of the fun of going away is planning these things. But to me, you should plan and then leave tons of room for serendipity to have her way with you.
Yeah, that's why I love urban travel, because, like, in a big city, there's always something around another corner. Like, there's the main streets and there's the main transit lines and what have you. Once you get out and you walk for about 10 minutes, there's always something around another corner, a new bar, a new bakery, a new pastry shop, a new shop that sells, you know, T-shirts, buttons, soaps, whatever. There's always something new around the corner.
That's true. And, you know, the sort of gateway cities, I love to spend sort of 48 hours just kind of exploring, walking. I'm a big fan of walking. I never take public transit. I mean, I think I've walked all of Paris. But then I have to say, I also love just getting out of Dodge and getting into the countryside. Something about the small towns, the villages and whatnot, there's an intimacy there that, you know, allows you to sort of see how the average person lives. So, the contrasts are great.
I find it interesting that you choose to shun public transit, because I find taking foreign public transit in a foreign city immerses me more with the locals, makes me feel a bit more like the locals, forces me to get my bearings better. But also, there are some places you want to go that are just outside of walking distance, that are just outside the city center. And you could walk there, but it might take you half a day just to walk there and drink your coffee and have a biscuit and then another half a day to come back. So I prefer public transit to get around and see more than just I would on foot. That's just me.
Okay, well, you've put a challenge up for me. Next time I'm the next gateway city I'm in, I'm going to get out my subway map and jump on.
When you say gateway city, do you mean like a historical port city, or you just mean like a large city that it's a jumping off point to other cities?
Yeah, I think mainly I mean, like, you know, when you're planning a trip, you know, you land in Paris, even if you're going to the Dordogne, or you land in Rome or whatnot. You know, to me, those are, I choose the city I want to land in that I also want to see. Mm-hmm. And I want to do the sort of groovy urban thing for 48 hours and then, you know, hit the road, either take my car or hop on a train or whatnot. So, that's always part of my trip planning, is where my plane lands.
So obviously in the Yucatan, you had a spiritual experience or somewhat of one. How often do you like to mix in spiritual with just the tangible experiences?
Well, I'm definitely not a woo-woo girl, but I love, you know, I'm just open to anything and I'm open to whatever feels authentic. I think one of the really cool things about the Temescal experience for me was that it wasn't some sanitized, like, gentrified spa on the coast with, you know, gorgeous spa boys. It was a, you know, dirt track, you know, 2 hours into the jungle, and this was an authentic neighborhood gathering point. There was no electricity. And, you know, afterwards we went swimming in the cenote. We went, like, you know, 60 feet down, lit by candlelight. And, you know, the bats were flying above. So it was cool, but it was also, you know, just very real and gritty. And I'm, you know, it's not hard to feel the spiritual vibe when it's that authentic.
Would you recommend that for anyone, you know, seeking a spiritual experience, or even if someone who doesn't consider themselves a woo-woo person?
No, I mean, I'm definitely open to, I would definitely say that Mexico in general, again, this is looking past the stereotypes, because, you know, you think of the all-inclusives and there are some less attractive stereotypes that are going, but there is a beautiful, mystical, authentically mystical culture there. It is, you know, just layers of ancient civilizations. There's an authenticity there, and a beauty and a gentleness to the people. They are genuinely happy and kind and welcoming. It's a truly wonderful place, and it is a place I definitely will go back to. Thanks for listening. I'm Liz Beattie. You've been listening to Native Traveler on Canada Talk, Sirius XM 167. If you want more information, go to nativetraveler.com. We're on Instagram at Native Traveler. And share your travel stories and what you'd like to hear more of at info@nativetraveler.com. Until next time.